Thank you for being here today. If you're visiting with us, we want you to know you're a special guest. It will only be just a few more weeks, we'll say just a few more months, and your new preacher and his family will arrive here in Benton. You will notice this week that their name and address is listed in the bulletin, and you have been encouraged to write them a note. And I really want to encourage you to do that. Welcome them to the family here. Do what you can to assist them and encourage them. Help them to get off on the right foot as they begin this new work. I hope you'll take that on as your personal responsibility this week to send a note of encouragement to this family. There are millions of people around this old world who just are not making it. They have never known Christ. They've never loved Him. They have never given their lives to Him. And they die before they ever lived. I've often wished that such would be the dichotomy of the thing, that it would be that easy. Those who've never met Christ don't make it. Those who have do make it. That would be all too simplistic, would it not? For you and I are both aware of the hundreds, thousands, and millions who have given their lives to Jesus Christ, who have seen His love for them and felt His power in their lives, who have honored Him with their lips and with their hearts, with their days and with their ways. And for all of those, do you realize there are so many millions more who just have not made it? Why is that so? Why do people not make it? Why is it that we hear so often of Bill? He was so enthusiastic, so involved, a part of every single assembly. You remember Bill, don't you? He had a Bible study group that met at his house, and they talked about God and His Word. He was a ministry leader in something that we had going on up here. I just can't quite remember what it was. But Bill was here all the time. He was one of those people who lived out Christ on the job and actually found some of his workmates coming to Jesus and being led to salvation over the years. Someone shrugs their shoulders and says, "Whatever happened to Bill?" I don't know. I can't remember the last time that I saw him. For some reason or reasons, Bill just didn't make it. Probably you have read Paul's second letter to the young preacher Timothy. And in that letter, he instructs him to give much attention to the public reading of the Scripture. I can imagine that there were several in that audience as the letter was read aloud in their hearing who sat just sort of looking in the dust, scribbling with the toe of their sandal. When he came to the line, chapter 4 and verse 9, "For Demas has forsaken me." Heads came up and jaws dropped down. And somebody said, "Who did he say?" "Demas. Demas, what happened?" "I don't know. Just gone. Just didn't make it." One of the saddest passages in all of the New Testament is the text that says he began to build, but he just could not finish it. Psalm 73 says, "I know the Lord is good. I know the Lord is good to Israel. But as for me, my foothold was almost gone. My feet had begun to slip." In the middle of the Corinthian letter, Paul would say to that group of his brethren, "Do not give up. Don't give up. Don't quit and don't become weary in doing what is right." I read in the Old Testament the story of the life of Saul, a life that began so very well. His life and his kingdom begins with the text literally saying, "A man standing head and shoulders above all of Israel," and it ends with his corpse hanging on the wall, Bethshan. Just didn't make it. Just didn't finish. And I suppose that there our loved ones and friends and even relatives of yours who have never come to know Christ. And as you reflect on their life, now they have died before they ever lived. And you feel the burden of that. The burden of those also who have come to know Christ, friends of yours, relatives of yours. And yet they died while they were still breathing. Why is that? Why is it that there are so many in this life who just don't seem to make it? There are many reasons. And I think one of the reasons is because they are worn down and they are worn out. Some people don't as well as they began, bound by the inequities of life. Born as you were, children looking at life with great hope and aspiration, zeal and ambition over the course of time and the course of their life, they're just beaten down. And it is day by day and week by week and year after year. It's not that they just came apart and unraveled and fragmented in one terrible moment of stress. It is that they wearied of and they suffered a hurt day in and day out. She lived what appeared to be a normal life. Her name was Alice. She leaned in the doorway of her home, and that's how most of her neighbors reflected and remembered her. She would just sort of prop herself against the side of the doorway, arms folded across her chest, and she was wearing one of those long aprons that housewives used to wear. She was thin, though, way too thin. 32 years old, had four kids, had a husband who was really just a drunken bum. Wasn't rude, didn't make a sight of himself in the neighborhood, but he would get liquored up and he just enjoyed beating her, and he enjoyed it often. Neighbors would say that she was one of those people that you know in your life who from the cradle all the way to the grave just never really knew any joy. Never knew the joy of walking into a little shop and seeing some little trinket there that she would like to have and just buying it. She didn't have a penny. And they said they would often find her weeping over the kids and how she would feed them and how she would pay their bills. She was a beautiful girl. Her skin was like porcelain. And at age 32, when they finished her second heart surgery and just gently closed her bigger-than-life blue eyes and put her in the ground, there at the graveside, friends and family and neighbors and relatives just shrugged. What do you say? What do you say about a life like that? She was just worn down. She was just worn out. No breaks, not a break. Nothing in life for her. There are so many people like that in the world, my friends, and they never know Christ. They never come to understand the life that He intended for them. They never enjoy living this life like Jesus intended for them to live it. And it is so very easy for all of us who are so richly blessed and who are not so burdened down to speak of how devout and noble and dedicated and joyous that we would be, even if we were not so richly blessed. We'd still be the same people, wouldn't we? Or would we? Take away your friends. Take away your father and mother who cared about you and Christ and who cared deeply about you and your relationship with Christ. Take away the grandparents who shaped and formed and molded you. Take away the Christian college that educated you. Take away the friends whose thoughts are centered around Jesus. And have you born in some distant street somewhere, take away all the good that you have known in your life and load you down with the life that people live in this community and in this country and in this world by the millions. And then under that load, tell me how noble you would be. Listen to me with such a hollow ring as I tell you how honorable that I would live. Jesus sat down and He watched the donkeys walking up and down the streets of Jerusalem, heads hanging down toward the dirt with that resigned, beaten look that donkeys get on their faces, burdens on their backs down. He watched an ox, big, heavy yoke, that big wooden thing on its back, just about to pull its shoulders off, pulling that load from one end of the field all the way to the other, and then turning around and pulling it back in the opposite direction, and turning around and repeating the process and doing it again and again, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, until finally his life is over. Do you remember what Jesus thought of? Do you remember what he said? He didn't just think about oxen. He thought about people burdened down by their lives. And so he said to them, "You come to me, all of you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And you take the yoke that I have for you and learn from me. For I am meek and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your soul." And someone says, "Well, how could anyone then, these ones that you spoke of who met him, eventually turn away from him? How could they ever start down that path with him and then not finish? How could they not find in him the power to see it through?" I ask you to consider, could it be that the religion that should have lifted their hearts and given them hope, the religion that should have made the difference in their lives, the religion that should have helped them deal with their sickness and live with their exploitation and handle their oppression and face their loneliness, the God that was meant to carry them and the religion that was meant to give them hope, is it possible, just possible, that it could have been presented to them as just one more additional burden in their life? Isn't that precisely what Jesus saw all around him? That the God who was to carry them was presented as nothing more than just another burden, and instead of being lifted and filled and raised with hope, they were just additionally crushed by it all. Friends, people in this life don't make it because they're worn out by life's inequities. And they don't make it because they struggle so with sin and they don't know how to deal with it. Somehow we give this picture to them that you come to Christ, you walk into Christ, and you give sin one good hard punch squarely in the nose, and it's all over. You've handled it. And you walk away from that with no problem. Would you listen to what Arthur Gossip writes? "Those who fail in religion, the great majority do it through sheer depression and a daunted feeling that it's been proven to be of no use, in their case anyway. It's been proved to be of no use to say yes to God and to try and struggle against sin. At best, things turn out not at all like they'd expected. For you know what they had supposed? They'd supposed that one hard battle against sin would have settled the whole issue, that there'd be nothing left but the hunting down of a few broken groups of disheartened evils and then the procession for life through the cheering streets of their righteousness. That's what they expected. But to their dismay, they awaken to discover that they are immersed, not in one hard battle, but in a long campaign of dull trench warfare. And day to day, there's not much vital that seems to happen. And they grow heartsick of the mud and the shelling, the brave rushes that appear to make no appreciable difference, growing heartsick of it all. So they patch up a poor compromise, a kind of makeshift and dishonorable peace, and they slink off home where things go more wrong, tragically. Finally, they fling down their weapons and surrender. They stop trying. They assume hopelessly that there is nothing else that can be done. And they let the fierce currents of their own nature drift them from where they will. That, he concludes, is how souls go down. They're beaten down. And we make them promises about this evil that is in their lives. One good shot and it'll all be over. And the promise is all too discouraging to live with. People aren't making it because they're worn down by life's inequities, because they're worn down and beaten down by their struggle against sin. And they have this sneaking suspicion in the recesses of their mind that for all of the preacher's talk and for all of the teacher's teaching, God really, really doesn't give a rip about it all anyway. How could He? They look at the enormity of the universe and of all the suffering in the world. They look at our nation and all of the problems that we are facing. They look at the enormity of their own lives and all of the problems there. And how could the God of heaven pretend to say that He would care about all of this? Now, before you dismiss this as some silly little look of a worldly person at his life, could I remind you that David would write the words, "Father, I have taken a look at it all. I've considered the whole world, and the one question I've got is, how in the world could You care about me?" So people in the world see all of the problems and their own inadequacies, and they are dead certain that God is not for them. They look in the mirror in the morning when they're shaving or putting on the makeup, and they say, "You're not fooling anybody. You're not getting away from it. You're not getting away with it. You think you're making some big splash, but the world sees through you. You are paltry and trivial and insignificant. You think 5 minutes of religious excitement is going to make up for years of indifference. You know better. Nobody's buying it." Pretty soon they walk away. Like Bill. Remember him? And if you're paying attention, they do it under the hard stare of the rest of the dedicated, and they feel that they fully deserve it. And it just serves as a reminder that even the friends of God don't really care, so how could He? Friends, I think people aren't making it because they're bored, powerless, and listless with the Christ that they are hearing presented. And it seems sometimes that the big issue in the church is finance and instrumental music, communion and baptism. And it seems that much of our preaching is how we are so right on so many issues. And I would confess to you, dear Lord, there are some days when I don't want to hear anymore about how right I am. I want to know if God is there for me. I want to know if God is going to make a difference in my life. I want to know if God is not only going to forgive me, but give to me some drive and some purpose and some meaning for this physical existence that I have. I want to know if in God there is really the power for me to see it through. Someday when my life is over, that God will have been with me. And as I stand in His presence and confess, "God, I loused it up, and I know I did, but the little I did it to honor You. I did it in hopes that someday someone would say, 'I'm glad Jim was alive. It made a difference for me.'" Our teaching so often is to correct the views on certain issues to those who have heard them for years. The exposition of the error of those who are not even present among us. And I have to confess to you this morning, I want more than that. I want more than that for my children. I want more than that for my grandchildren. I want more than that for the lost of the community. I want more than that for the world. And I would like for people to begin to see what God has been saying to us for all of eternity. That He loves us, Christian and non-Christian alike, and that He and He alone is the only one who brings the power to see it through all of this. Now, honestly, I know that some of you have never had a doubt about that. That smile is always on your face. Your life is always smooth, and God bless you. I really believe you know where that power comes from. There are others of you who have so constricted and narrowed your life, you are only going to carry the burden of your choice. You're only going to carry it as far as you choose and as long as you choose. And bless your heart, you can't even conceive of this notion, the power to see it through what? Who would need the power to see it through? People are struggling. Who's struggling? I have no message for those who feel no pain. I have no message for those who are not aware of and do not care about the lost condition of so many people in the world. So this morning, and really probably for the next three Sunday mornings, we're just going to be involved in a little strugglers talk for fellow strugglers. It takes me a while sometimes to get these sermons to their completion. We're just going to talk about the struggles that people have in this life. And if you are one of those who has so narrowed your own life and refused to take upon yourself what the Scripture would call the fellowship of His sufferings, you lose. There is no message for you. The message is for the Catherine Mansfields of the world. Perhaps you've heard that name, Catherine Mansfield. Born in New Zealand, died at age 35 in France. Writer of some of the most tremendous short stories that have ever been written. If you've never read the works of Catherine Mansfield, you should. Her friends told her all of her life, "Catherine, you are brilliant." And just a casual reading of her works will bear witness to her extraordinary brilliance. Around age 30, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis and she began to die. 2 days before her death, two of her dearest friends sat down with her, sat at her bedside. She could not stop crying, and they were trying to help her. They were trying to comfort her, but she just couldn't speak. She just kept crying. And so finally, one of her friends said, "Why are you crying so? Is it dying?" She said, "No, not at all. It's not dying. It's my stories. They aren't any good. And I'm realizing at this moment that I could not show not even one of them to God." Brothers and sisters, where in the world, where in this world did she hear about a God like that? Where? Where in the world did she hear about a God who is not for you? Where did she learn about a God who does not empower His people? Where did she come to the conclusion about a Father who would not accept her and graciously love and live in her? Where did she hear that? Possibly in one of our churches? Perhaps from a pulpit somewhere? I wonder when we're going to realize where we get the power to make it through this life. We're all just muddling our way through, are we not? Don't we all just get up every day and give it our very best shot to make it through as best we can? Convinced someday when we stand before Christ, those who are redeemed, we will hear Him say, "I am so glad that you are here." And I remind you that He's not going to say it because of who you are or what you've done. He will say those words because of who He is and what He has done. You will realize in the fullness of His grace that you made it not because of you. You made it because of Him. Can you hear the Son of God saying, "I love you, and I'm glad you're here," and your response might be, "God, I messed it up so, and I wanted so badly to do it well, and in retrospect and reflection, I don't feel like I did a day of it well." Perhaps the Lord would concur, "You know, you could have done better. I knew all along you could have done better, but that's why I came. It's why I gave what I gave, and you're all right here." Perhaps you'll experience the pain of that and the humbling of that, but you will also feel the joy and the wonder of that. And understanding it now and recognizing it at whatever point you are in your life, it will give to you the desire to muddle less and to live more powerfully. Don't you want to live so that somewhere, somehow, someday, dead or alive, somebody stands before God and calls your name and says, they made a difference for me? So could we to at least just introduce, just begin by you and I saying that we know and understand to see it through. Where it is that you find the power for living with life's inequities, where you find the power to deal with your daily struggle with sin, that you know beyond the shadow of any doubt where you find the power to struggle with your occasional faithlessness, that you know without any way you find the power to live with a religion that oftentimes is much less for you than God intends that it be, that you know wherein you find your walk. Where do people get the power to see it through? They get it from God. God is the one who helps you through. And friends, I wonder when we're ever going to learn that. I wonder when we're going to learn ever, wherever, whenever, lives honorably, decently, and sacrificially before the Lord. There is nobody ever did that without God enabling them to. Nobody has ever done what that God did not gift them to do it. This whole nonsense that God is working only in the lives of a list of folks that I identify and does nothing in the lives of those who don't happen to be on my list is just that. It's sheer nonsense. How do you explain 10 men who were healed? 9 of them were Jews. One of them was a pagan. Who moved that one pagan to be the one to express his gratitude? How do you explain being in the middle of a Jewish metropolis, synagogues on every corner, and it is this pagan centurion that Jesus walks up to and says, would you get a load of this guy? Can you beat this guy? Have you ever heard anything like this guy? I've been up north. I've been down south. I've been from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, and I have not seen faith like this. This man is very close to the kingdom. God does that to people. And by His grace, when it's done to you and it's done to me. He is striving to work His grace in us. And this thought that I am the center of my salvation, I am the center of my life and my universe, and if I would just reach down and yank on my own bootstraps hard enough, God is just waiting to kick in, and when I do that, He will. That's junk theology. I'm going to tell you, friends, this book teaches you that nobody takes hold of anything in this life without God enabling them to. Romans chapter 12, Paul says, it is He who transforms us, it's not me. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, he reminds his brethren, you get your eyes on Him. And it is His Spirit that will change you from one degree of glory to another degree of glory. So I ask you this morning to consider, what do you have that God did not place in your life? Friends, if there is any, and mine, it's simply because God enabled there to be a difference. If there is any power granted to see it through this physical journey to eternity, it will be the power of God at work in you. The power of God alone. And so if His grace is calling you to make a difference in your circumstance and in your life, and if you have tried under your own steam and your own power for so long to make it through, and you're recognizing that you cannot do that, and you must humbly surrender your life to Him. I don't know, perhaps just these introductory thoughts this morning will compel you to say, I'm confessing Him, and I am trusting Him, and I am giving my life to Him, and I am believing Him, because I've lived long enough to recognize that I'm not going to do this thing on my own. Perhaps you need to say that before this audience. And maybe in response, you need to confess the name of Jesus and be immersed into Christ in obedience to Him. Maybe you need to do that before this group today. Nothing would thrill us more than to find another in touch with the one who loves you more than any other. And if you need to make that touch, that connection between yourself and Him, He is able this morning. You don't have to be. There is the image of a cross that faces all of us and our lives. The caption says, whatever you have done, whatever you have become, it does not matter. Redemption is available through the blood of Jesus. Please come home. We'll work on these thoughts over the course of the next 2 to 3 Sundays together as we try and recognize, as we live this life, this temporal, physical life, this mist that appears for such a short time and then just vanishes away. We'll try to understand and learn together that there is only one place that we find the power to see it through. And that is through the gracious gift of God our Father, the gift, the unspeakable gift of His Son, Jesus. Think on those things, would you? If you'd like to make a response to the invitation of Christ this morning, we extend the invitation now. Let's stand together.